This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight:
militiamen loyal to the unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides.
That's Edward Yeranian reporting from Cairo. Details next.
Also, a U.S. general says Islamic State militants are very likely to shift their focus to ungoverned regions of Africa. A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government reached a ceasefire with a militant group that's targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli, the capital, have reported making gains inside the Islamic State-held coastal city of Sirte. More than 35 militia died in today's fighting there. Also, a rival government in Tobruk to the east says it has pushed back al-Qaeda militants in Benghazi. And about 30 civilians died in Tripoli when an ammunition dump exploded. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Militiamen loyal to the unity government captured two districts inside Sirte amid heavy fighting and reports of casualties on both sides. Ahmed Hadia, a spokesman for pro-government military forces in Sirte, told Libyan TV that battles took place in several areas.
قوات البنيان المرصوص حققت تقدما على جميع المحاور في الزعفران والغربيات.
He says pro-government militiamen had pushed IS fighters out of the Zafran and Garbiat districts and quartered them in small pockets of the 700 district and the Ouagadougou conference center. Islamic State fighters were reported to be fighting fiercely despite recent losses, using car bombs, suicide attackers, and other booby-trapped objects. A government military commander in Sirte told journalists that IS fighters had booby-trapped vehicles and shops to stop the government advance into the city. The Libya Herald newspaper reported that 170 pro-government militiamen have been killed and over 700 injured since the start of the military operation dubbed Bunyan al-Marsous to retake Sirte. The paper added that many of the casualties in the fighting were taken to Misrata Central Hospital, where doctors refused to allow journalists to take photos. It indicated that many of the wounded had suffered horrific injuries and that conditions at the hospital were poor because of shortages of drugs, antibiotics, and even nurses. Arab media also reported heavy fighting inside Libya's second largest city of Benghazi, as forces loyal to the government in Tobruk fought to expel Islamic militants loyal to al-Qaeda. Heavy clashes against militants took place in the nearby port of Ajdabiya several days ago. A spokesman for Libyan military units in the east of the country, loyal to Army Commander Khalifa Haftar, told journalists that his forces were advancing against the militants near the district of Sabri and Souk al-Hout near Benghazi. The Libyan army has made similar claims of gains against militants in Benghazi in the past. Forces loyal to General Haftar have also carried out airstrikes against Islamic militant positions near Ajdabiya and the eastern militant stronghold of Darna in recent days. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Hey. A U.S. general testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday that Islamic State militants are very likely to shift their focus to ungoverned regions of Africa. Lieutenant General Thomas Waldhauser told committee members yesterday that the Islamic State's current defense of the city of Sirte in Libya is a backup position to territories under their control in the Middle East. Waldhauser also talked about another militant force in northwest Nigeria. He says about half of the Boko Haram forces recently formed a separate group that is even more aligned with Islamic State beliefs. The general said he is concerned this new splinter group could attack Western targets.
The Eritrean ambassador to the United Nations has told the UN Human Rights Council that he believes neighboring Ethiopia is preparing to attack their border. Girma Asmarantesfe says that there is clear evidence that Ethiopia has adopted a hostile policy. Asmaram has told VOA his charge is based on statements made in the Ethiopian parliament. He says Ethiopia wants regime change in Eritrea's capital, Asmara. Ethiopian officials dismissed the charge. Eritrean and Ethiopian troops recently clashed along their borders at the Sirona Central Front, an area located south of Asmara. Eritrea's foreign ministry also has accused the United States of playing a role of instigating a recent clash between the two countries. State Department spokesman John Kirby has dismissed the accusation and urged the two countries to work toward a stable and peaceful region.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government had reached a ceasefire with a militant group that's targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure. The Niger Delta Avengers militants, however, deny reaching any such truce with the government. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company, who spoke to VOA on condition of anonymity, confirmed the ceasefire deal, but offered no further details. The Niger Delta Avengers militant group said on Twitter no ceasefire had been agreed to. Months of attacks by the Avengers on petroleum infrastructure in the Delta have dropped Nigeria's oil production by as much as half from its usual level of around 2 million barrels per day. Oil is Nigeria's top export. Economists have cited the drop in production as one reason the country's economy, which is Africa's largest, will soon enter a recession. Earlier this month, the government announced it was suspending military operations in the Delta to pave the way for talks. The vice president for Africa operations at intelligence firm Stratfor, Mark Schroeder, says the ceasefire may be a delaying tactic by Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari.
It could be by time while President Buhari has to essentially negotiate or calculate among his other political constituencies, you know, whether he can afford to increase revenue sharing with the Niger Delta region.
The Southern Delta region is home to almost all of Nigeria's oil production, but remains deeply impoverished. Militancy is nothing new there. A similar insurgency raged until 2009, when the government started paying off fighters and giving them job training in exchange for their halting attacks. The Avengers, a mysterious group that communicates primarily through a Twitter account, could not be reached for comment. In a statement last week, the Avengers demanded the federal government commit to independently mediated talks. The confusion over the truce's existence may be a sign of factionalism within the Avengers, Schroeder said, or it may just be impatience with the Buhari administration. Much of what the group is demanding are resolutions to long-standing grievances in the Delta.
What they want to see above all is some reasonable offer of engagement by the Buhari government.
The Avengers' most recent attack was June 16th. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A Nigerian philanthropist is publishing a book based on 50 years of research on Nigeria's outcast system titled Love and Stigma, the Outcast System. The author, Sir Adolphus Ekijuba, is a retired geologist and community activist. He says Nigeria will be able to abolish the outcast system in Nigeria so that people who have been stigmatized and discriminated against for years can achieve freedom and justice. He spoke with me about his research, the deep-rooted causes of class discrimination, and his work with Nigeria's underprivileged communities.
The problem is there is class discrimination whereby some people are classed as outcasts and some as freeborn. And this is happening in Nigeria, among the Igbo tribe, in India, and in some other countries in Africa and Asia. This leads to discrimination and stigmatization. People from one group are not allowed to interact freely with the other. There is no intermarriage, and because of that, these people are denied a lot of their fundamental human rights.
What is the driving force that allows this to continue in this day?
The main thing is associated with mindset. It is not affecting everybody, and those affected are in a minority, and that's why the majority of the people tend to overload it over the others. People claim that it was instituted by our forefathers, and that's why they will not be the ones to stop it. But I have reason to show them that that is not a good argument, because there are many other institutions of practices that were made by our forefathers that we have stopped, like the killing of twins, like the use of human hair to bury important people, like moving about naked or half-naked, like the non-education of the girl child, female genital mutilation, idol worship, punitive widowhood practices. But I tell them, these things have to stop. We stop these ones because it affected everybody. While the other one, the outcast system, is not affecting everybody. And for that, people tend to look at it without minding how it affects the others. And that's why I call on my fellow learned people, the educated people in the non-outcast system, to join forces to stop this outcast system.
Now, I understand there's an outcast system elimination project going on. Can you tell me about the project and how that is working to help eliminate some of these prejudices?
What we are doing is to educate people, because we don't want to do it by force, to let people understand why this is wrong and why we should stop it. We have looked at where people are the same, from science, from religion, from sociology. We have put facts and figures that prove that all people are the same, and therefore there should not be any more further discrimination between people.
Is this actively going on now, for instance, in some African countries where people are on the ground out educating people?
Yes, this is actually what I have initiated. Some efforts in the past to stop it did not quite work, and that's why I have written this book, Love and Stigma, the Outcast System, where I've listed out the various reasons why we should stop the outcast system. I've tried to make presentations in churches and in communities before coming out here. And the essence of coming out here is to enlighten the international community to assist in fighting against our brothers and sisters called the outcasts.
Do you have an example of a success story that you can share regarding someone or some group of people that have changed their traditional beliefs or prejudices?
Yes, in some parts of Igbo land, really, especially in the Anambra State, they have been able to overcome the outcast system and abolish it. In some other areas, because of religion, people have also abandoned the outcast system as a sub-part of their Christian belief. But in some other areas, it still keeps staying, and we want to make it a general practice that everywhere it occurs, it should be abandoned, because it's a human rights issue.
Sir Adolphus Ekijuba is a retired geologist and community activist. He is the author of the book Love and Stigma, the Outcast System. He spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiyis Wuhib. And at 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Forces loyal to Libya's new national unity government in Tripoli have reportedly made gains inside the Islamic State-held coast city of Sirte. A senior official at Nigeria's state-owned oil company has confirmed that the government has reached a ceasefire with the militant group that's targeted the country's vital oil infrastructure. And the Eritrean ambassador to the United Nations has told the UN Human Rights Council that he believes neighboring Ethiopia is preparing to attack their border. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The World Health Organization says South Africa has the highest rate of alcohol-related road deaths in the world. According to its 2015 Global Report on Road Safety, almost 60% of all fatalities happen because motorists are driving under the influence of liquor. The government says about 14,000 people are killed in road crashes every year. But independent analysts say the annual death toll is over 20,000, and they accuse the state of not doing enough to prevent drinking and driving. Darren Taylor reports in the third installment of a series examining South Africa's road safety crisis.
A scene repeated in bars across South Africa every day. A patron walks in, tosses his car keys on the counter, and starts drinking alcohol. Here, driving after consuming just two beers is illegal. But, says Caro Smith of the non-profit South Africans Against Drunk Driving, this isn't deterring the nation's dedicated drink drivers.
South Africa, unfortunately, has a great culture of drinking and driving. They seem to think it is their right. There is a big culture of being proud of being so drunk and not remembering where you parked your car or how you got home.
10 years ago, Smith was an alcohol and drug educator in schools. A big part of her job was to warn young people against driving under the influence of liquor.
And then, unfortunately, my own child, Chaz, was killed by a drink driver in 2005.
Smith now campaigns for better enforcement of the country's laws against drinking and driving.
We've got to get the person caught quickly. We've got to get justice to accept that it is a crime and implement the laws that are there. We've got very good laws. We're just not implementing them.
The World Health Organization says laws to prevent drink driving are poorly enforced in South Africa. Howard Dembowski is chairman of the Justice Project, an NGO that monitors South Africa's traffic sector and road laws.
We have the National Department of Transport telling the World Health Organization that 58% of road fatalities in South Africa involve alcohol, and yet we don't have proper alcohol enforcement.
South Africa's Department of Transport did not respond to VOA's numerous requests for reaction. But senior traffic police official Edna Mamonyane says officers launch regular operations to arrest people for drinking and driving. Smith says this isn't enough to prevent it.
There is a lot of lip service saying we want to stop it, and yet they're not using the internationally best practice methods of stopping it, like testing 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, and not just at Christmas or Easter time.
According to Justice Project research, only 6% of the thousands of people arrested annually for allegedly driving under the influence of alcohol are ever convicted. Dembowski says this is because of factors like botched investigations and police corruption. This woman, whose voice has been disguised to protect her identity, says she paid a cop to squash the drink driving charge against her son.
Everybody knows it costs you 10, 15 grand and you can get it to disappear.
In the rare cases that drunk drivers are convicted, says Smith, the results are mostly disappointing.
When people have drunk and killed or severely injured, they're giving them absolute slap on the wrist. They're not giving jail sentences.
South Africa's transport minister, Dipuo Peters, wants all suspected drunk drivers to be imprisoned until their court hearings are complete. But Dembowski says it's wrong to punish people before they've been convicted of a crime.
That is just not acceptable in any modern criminal justice system. You cannot presume people to be guilty until they prove themselves innocent. Our constitution says the exact opposite.
Dembowski says if Peters gets her way, tens of thousands of people will be languishing in South Africa's already overcrowded jails for a long time. In South Africa, it's law that blood from alleged drunk drivers must be tested to establish the alcohol level. Dembowski points out that the country's national testing laboratories have a huge backlog of blood samples related to drink driving cases.
Are you going to detain those people in jails until they are acquitted, which could take up to 10 years?
Because the test results are only available years after the alleged crimes, magistrates mostly abandon the cases against suspects, allowing serial drunk drivers back on the roads. Smit believes there'll be much less drink driving in South Africa if it becomes stigmatized, like in Australia, for example. 20 years ago, she says, many Australians didn't think driving under the influence was a crime. Then the Australian government ordered the police to test people at all hours of the day and night and to take strong action against drunk drivers.
What people then started to do was say to their friends, please don't drink and drive tonight. You're going to get a criminal record, or you're going to be put in jail, or you'll get a big fine. And so behavior changed because of the repercussions of the law actually tightening up.
Since 1997, the Australian authorities have tested tens of millions of motorists for driving under the influence, and arrests for the offence are now relatively rare. Smit urges South Africa to do the same. But, says Dembowski, if that was to work here, the government would have to introduce radical reforms, including ending traffic police corruption and transforming its testing, justice and prison systems. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people. Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.